Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning, good afternoon. Welcome to Blog Talk Radio and the Business Black Belt Radio Show. This is Burke Franklin, where every week I am working to help you build your business by listening to some entrepreneurs, some experts on business, some people who finance business, that means VCs, angel investors, give you the real story, what they really think behind the scenes, not the nice, fluffy, pretty stuff you read in academic whatevers. I want to get a reality check for you to really understand what it's going to take to build your business. Today, I've got Peter Howley. Peter Howley is with us. He's a prolific business leader. He's a five-time successful entrepreneur. He's advised and acted as an interim CEO for more than 30 companies in the last 20 years. He's invested in companies. He was a key member that really helped Exodus Communications get off the ground and become a wild success. He's helped a lot of companies. He knows a lot about businesses. He's been in them. He puts his money in them or has put his money in them. And continues to advise them as part of his Howley Management Group based in Petaluma. And he loves a good disruptive business. I know we're going to talk about that and get an idea what does it need to be disruptive. Anyway, without further ado, Peter, hello. Thank you for being here.
Hi, my pleasure. And I'm hoping this connection works well. Can you hear me okay?
Yeah, I can hear you fine.
Great. Well, looking forward to sharing some experience with your audience.
Do you want to tell a little more about your background, just to put a little finer point on it? I mean, I don't want to get into all of it, but it's you've done so many things. You're like the real deal here. So tell us a little more, please.
You know, I'll tell you a little some humor because it ties into my successes later. But when I got out of school with an engineering degree, I'd been in aircraft maintenance, and so I applied to the airlines, and all three of the airlines I applied to are long gone. And I wanted to become a manager and hopefully a president of a company someday. And AT&T, the big monopoly, had a management development program that washed out about 50% of the candidates after a year. But that's how I got started in telecom. And it basically was a monopoly back in pretty much all of history. And then and I hated the company, but I worked hard. I got an MBA at night. I did everything I could to learn as much as I could, despite the attitude of this, you know, almost government-like body. And then finally, I had to move on, and I was back east, and I jumped into a startup. And everybody back then thought, what the heck is wrong with Pete Howley? You know, everybody built great careers in big companies. AT&T was considered one of the best managed companies in the world. And there's a difference between management and leadership, which we might touch on. And I went with MCI as a startup. I opened up New York City as the ops manager and then helped them with L.A. and then did a whole series of other things, including dealing in the regulatory world. So I went from this giant, super-managed company to this purely entrepreneur type of entity. What a change. Later, I worked for about 9 years for a company that has the boring title of Citizens Utilities Company. But they had a division that ran, was a phone company out in Arizona that was in terrible shape. It was a very high-growth county. And I went out there for a couple of years. I ended up staying for 7.5. But it was a phenomenal experience. I learned so much about customers and customer service, as well as, you know, meeting very, very high demand, you know, when you're way behind the curve to begin with. But I was in Kingman, which is about 100 miles from Las Vegas. So I needed to get back to the more, you know, the bigger world, and I ended up with the startup that ultimately became Centex Telemanagement, headquartered in San Francisco. Took it public and ran it for 9 years. It's a Harvard Business School study. The 1 year on the Inc. list, it was the fastest growing service company and the fourth fastest growing company in America, and it was a wild experience. We were bought for a little bit under $250 million after 9 years. The original investors made 18 or 20 times their dollar investment. And you say, wow, that must have been something. I've got to turn off I've got you coming on my website here. But anyway, I was running during all of this scared to death.
Well, what were you doing? I mean, I listened to this, and you stayed with these companies. You learned about customer service. I just want, you know, without going too far afield here, but I'm just curious. You're doing something. You turn these companies around. What were they not doing that you went in there and said, oh, this needs to be done, and you just went after doing that? Is there something specific you did?
Well, that's a tough question to answer, too, because I was in a lot of different situations. But one of them is the point I was just leading up to, Andy Grove's book, Only the Paranoid Survive. Out here in Silicon Valley, everybody's a genius, and there's brilliant, and there's seriously brilliant people with great ideas. You know, there's 10,000 ideas every day almost. And what I think is the secret, at least for me, was that I didn't have any opinion that I knew all the answers. And so I was very careful to listen very carefully, to ask people questions, to make sure my associates in a company talked to me. They didn't hide from me, or they didn't pretend there was no problem if there was a problem. I needed a culture in those companies that was very open and honest. And tough, yes, I set high goals, you know, but you've got to, you know, so my secret was, you know, going out and making sales calls, calling on prospects. When a great salesman leaves, calling them up or calling her up and saying, why are you leaving? And understanding what wasn't working properly. When a customer leaves, the same thing, talking to the customer. The two points that I think are a little different from many CEOs is the one that I had no pretensions that I knew the answers, even though I'm pretty bright and I have, you know, a lot of background. But I went out and asked a lot of questions. And the other one is, you know, I'm going to say books. And people go, books, you got to be kidding. Books are invaluable, whether you're reading them on a Kindle or not. Books are invaluable sources of some in-depth information. And when I was out in Arizona, we had the union IBEW represented a bunch of our operations people. They're a tough union. They're solid. And so I got a couple books on negotiating, and which was helpful in other deals too. And part of the secret of negotiating was what does the other side want, and what do you want, and what don't you want, and what might they not want? So it's, you know, some analysis ahead of time, so you know you can probably reach. We had a 2-year contract with them over over decades, and we ended up with a 3-year one. And it wasn't because I was brilliant; it was because I did that homework. It just makes a difference. And then later, we had a group of disgruntled folks, and the Teamsters came in because one of our gals' father was a Teamster in the local copper mine. The Teamsters came in. Holy mackerel. Well, the IBEW stood by me because they liked my fairness and my honesty in dealing with them. They didn't support. They crossed the picket line. And at the same time, I got a couple of books and I talked to a few lawyers about, you know, what are my options here? And ultimately, we, quote, broke the Teamsters. And let me tell you, when you're messing with the Teamsters, you don't know if you want to start your car every morning. So the two things, two things that I found was, you know, I don't have any pretensions that I know all the answers, though I have opinions, but they can change. And I do a lot of research, a lot of it online today. But for an in-depth study, you know, it really does help to get a book. I actually get the physical book and I underline them, even if I never look at them again. It's a way to remind me again of what did I learn.
Well, you know, I was gonna say, listen to this. I know we want to talk about how to help entrepreneurs raise capital, build their businesses, get it right the first time, get lucky, build a big business. But I think what you're saying, what I get out of it, and I hear this a lot. I give, you know, some talks to entrepreneurs and things, and talk to them every day, really. And it's amazing the difference between a person, and this is like in all walks of life, not just somebody building a business. It could be at a cocktail party or wherever. And somebody will have an opinion, and they're so locked down in the opinion, there's no room for any new information. The world changes. Data changes. Science comes up with something new. There's a new discovery. There's, you know, research and all that. But their opinion is locked down hard, and they don't really let in some new information. Not that I'm trying to change somebody's opinion, And I get that it really is all a point of view one way or the other. We all see something from a different perspective. Nothing. It's like those five blind men and the elephant. You know, one grabs the leg and thinks it's a tree, and one touches the stomach and thinks it's a wall, and, you know, the ears is a leaf, or, you know, all that. It's still an elephant. And what it, you know, and I see this is a horrific detriment to many entrepreneurs. You'll critique their business plan, or they'll give their investor pitch, and you'll hear something and say, wait, you need to talk about this or that. And they go, well, we've already done this, and we're doing that, and they get really defensive. And you just think, ooh, my checkbook goes back in my pocket, like, ooh, you know, I'm not giving this guy any money because he's not going to listen to any direction or take in any new information. And so, I mean, right out the chute, I think that's really like almost one of the most important things anybody can really get from this is you need to, yeah, have your opinion, but, you know, it's got to be a flexible opinion because you may not be right, or at least what you're thinking is either outdated or something you heard from your parents or something somebody told you somewhere or you read somewhere, and it's just not accurate.
Yeah. It's a really important point because if some of my worst clients that have not been particularly successful just didn't get your point, they didn't listen. And one of them has been struggling along, making, you know, paying, keeping in business, but not making any money for almost 20 years. And I introduced him to a very, very well-known angel investor out here. And we had lunch together for an hour and a half or so. And afterwards, I got a call from the angel investor. And he said, Pete, does he understand that if I don't like him, I'm not going to invest in his business no matter what? And you know, yeah, exactly. And that, it leads up to the other piece that, to me, has been very helpful. I gave a talk. I was the main speaker on mentoring at an NYU mentor fair, you know, for their entrepreneur fair. And I thought, I don't follow anybody. I've never had a formal mentor, and I don't, you know, I follow my own course. I'm an entrepreneur. I'm an independent type. But I had to give a talk on the topic, and I thought about it, and I said, I didn't think of these people as mentors, but they absolutely were. They were bosses in some cases. In some cases, they were my peers at work. In a couple cases, they were outsiders. But they were mentors because they had something to say that was important to what I was doing, and I listened, and I heard them. And, you know, and it ties into another point that ties into that, the attitude, which is so important. When you're raising money, or when I was running a public company, every quarter we had analysts, and of course there's a few who are shorting your stock, and they get in there and try to mess up the phone call. What I try to tell people, particularly entrepreneurs, when they're raising their first money with venture capitalists can be very tough, and so can angels, is every question is an opportunity. Don't take it as a challenge. That's what this fellow I mentioned a minute ago, it took it as a challenge. You know, he'd teach you a lesson. But the tough questions are great opportunities to answer the problem. There are also things you may want to go back and think about it. Somebody may bring up an issue that's a real problem.
I was recently schooled on the whole investor pitch, you know, that proverbial 10-minute pitch or 20-minute pitch at the VC office. And what always annoyed me so much is can I just give my presentation and ask the questions later, you know? And it's not going to happen. That's just part of the reality check. And they're not going to let you just talk and talk and talk and not ask questions. And like you say, when they asked a question, I thought it was annoying when they interrupted me and asked a question. And what I realized from that presentation, that whole thing, and as well as from sales, my sales experience in the past, is when a customer asks a question or an investor asks a question, they're interested. Because I know, you know, when I'm not interested in something, I don't care. I'm not going to ask any questions. I'm not interested. So if somebody asks a question, they're obviously expressing some kind of interest. And like you say in the investor presentation, if they interrupt you, it's an opportunity to explain something and address them with it. And a lot of people really are really annoyed by that. And I want to say to our listeners that rethink your approach there.
Yeah.
Anyway.
No, it's extremely good advice because we all get defensive when we're attacked. And you cannot look at it that way. You have to look at it as an opportunity to answer a question. And frequently they are important, and if you answer them properly, and by the way, there's times a short, this is an important point too, I forgot about, but there's times a short answer is better than a long answer. And particularly if you're giving, I was involved in the antitrust case against AT&T when I worked for MCI, and so I was on the, and I've been involved in other regulatory issues when I was defending our company, Syntex Telemanagement. The sometimes if you can give a short answer that addresses it, and then you say, you know, does that answer your question? They go, yeah. And sometimes if you give a real long answer and 5 minutes later you're finished, you've raised 17 more worries and concerns, and they're wondering, you know, if you'd given a real, sometimes they're complex, you have to, but if you're giving a real long answer, why? And what do you, that can be a real alarm to people. So, you know, they shouldn't be three sentence answers, but you want to keep an answer short. See if it answered the question. Make sure if it didn't, then, you know, find out what and take it a little further. But you don't need to spend 15 minutes on it. You just raise all kinds of alarms, particularly if you're a little bit evasive. Boy, if you're a little bit evasive, all the alarms go off.
Yeah, it is a great quote, something about if you hide the truth, and the human nature, something just suspects the worst. So, yeah. So I'm going to talk about entrepreneurs. So one of your questions we talked about a while back was, were entrepreneurs made or born? I feel like I was born to be an entrepreneur, but I don't know about that. I mean, I think about my influence of my grandfather and like that, but I wonder today. A lot of people are thinking, you know, I'm really not an entrepreneur. I work for a company, but I'm laid off, or I got an idea, but I'm not really an entrepreneur. But what do you think about that? Are they made or born?
You know, one, I don't have a conclusive answer, but one of the things, you know, we have, America has a great deal of entrepreneurship. We probably lead the world in that area. Perhaps Israel would be close. And there are a number of other companies, and there are certainly many places that are trying to use this as a model. And I suspect part of that is the culture we're raised in. You know, our foreparents and all were pioneers. They came out, you know, they left the parent country for whatever reason, and they had to, you know, survive in a foreign country and build a lifestyle and move west and all of that. So, and I was, a couple of years ago, I was at an Irish entrepreneur meeting. They were looking at doing some work with us and vice versa. And I was very surprised at the comment made by there that in Ireland, because I'm part Irish, that if you start something and it fails, you're kind of marked forever. So the culture that you're raised in definitely makes a difference. I also think if you're, you know, my background is a little different from the normal. My dad went off to World War II, and then afterwards he was a reservist, but he was stuck becoming military commandant of Berlin as the Cold War started, and I was living there as a little kid. And the Russians shut the city off and tried to starve 2 1/3 million people, and we had to survive with airplanes bringing food in and also coal for the power plants. That was a little different background than normal, and then we moved quite a few times as he got reestablished back in civilian life. So it's hard to know. I think the environment of a family and a history and the community you grow up in has a huge amount to do with, you know, how much you're willing to take a chance to be an entrepreneur. But I think some people just don't follow the line where others do. And I tend to think entrepreneurs tend to be, don't follow the line. Remember that old cartoon years ago with a whole bunch of people walking to the left and there's one guy running to the right. He's the entrepreneur. So I think you can encourage people who might not naturally be entrepreneurs to be entrepreneurial. And I think if you come out of a bigger company where you get some great experiences, I did at AT&T, and you go into a smaller company that's a startup that's purely entrepreneurial, so, you know, fighting to create the business, it tends to support and encourage it because you're living it. So
yeah,
Burke, the answer to are they born or created, are the answer is yes.
I was going to say sometimes, yeah, I see something that the world, clearly the world needs. Like when I created the BizPlan Builder business planning software, there, you know, people were writing business plans by hand, and, you know, no one really knew how to write them. And I saw so many bad ones, and I thought, you know, wow, nobody's got a business plan template that others can follow. I could make one of those. And, you know, so I started the business. It was a bit of an accidental business in that regard. But there's also ones where you just see where there's something needed and no one's doing anything. You know, I could figure out how to connect the dots here and, you know, buy the stuff and make the thing and get it in front of people and enough people buy it and the price is reasonable and there's a profit there. Hey, you know, I don't need to get all hung up on, am I an entrepreneur or a business owner? What am I? I'm just started this business. I saw an opening here, a need to fill, and I'm doing it. And that's about as easy, as simple as that, you know?
Yeah. You know, I wrote a paper that was published a few years ago that addressed what I looked for as an investor, but it's also a template for what an entrepreneur, and I learned it by being an entrepreneur and by being an investor, but what should an entrepreneur be looking at? And I had five major points. But the first one is the point you've just made, Burke, is that does the business make sense? You know, just does it make sense? And it seems like so obvious, but some of them are great ideas, but does the business make sense, not the technology, particularly from the customer's viewpoint? And one way to find out is to sell that product and, you know, early on just to see, or to go out and visit people to see if there's a real pain or a real need there. But you know, so many business plans, they're not presented very well. That's a different topic. But if they don't make great business sense, in fact, maybe if we could, I'll take a couple minutes and just outline my five points.
Please, yeah, that sounds great.
Okay. Well, the first one, of course, is, you know, is maybe the most important one is does it make sense, particularly from the customer's viewpoint. The second one, and this has been the cause of most of the failures that I've seen or I've been involved with, the most frequent cause of failure, is what's the sales channel? How is the business going to get its product or its service to the customer? And, you know, people used to say, well, we'll get AT&T and Verizon to carry it. That may be fine, but you really have to look very closely at, okay, how are you going to make that happen? Are we going to use social media and social networking and all of that to trigger an interest in it? That's fine. They work for businesses, but are we going to use channel partners? And again, that may work, but sometimes getting the channel partners to agree to carry your product is the issue, but the bigger issue is getting the salespeople to understand it, get enthusiastic about it, and sell it. So
right.
That's the sales channel and how you're going to get the product to the customer. That's the one that really smart technology people and technology service people tend to underestimate the most. The third one, you know, you talk about stages of a company. The first stage is the startup. How do you figure out if the business flies or not? And you finally get a couple customers and you have some revenue and the numbers make sense. So the third point is, what's your competitive advantage? And if you really begin to hit a spot and you've discovered a marketing need that's not met, at that point, in that stage of your company, you've got to accelerate growth immediately, because Cisco and Intel and Oracle, you know, the big guys are going to see that, and they're going to come charging in there with all the horsepower that they have and the reputation and all. And so at that point, that third stage of your competitive advantage, the acceleration stage of a company, you want to grow as fast as you can. You've got to bring salespeople on or bring more, whatever the sales approach is. You've got to expand it as fast as you can, because when the big guy comes in, you want him to buy you for an outrageous price. And if you have to compete head on him, you want to have enough of a reputation and speed going at that point that their size and financing, you know, isn't a huge advantage. The third one, of course, is the financials. Do the numbers make sense? And numbers are purely a matter of the assumptions. And I look at the assumptions very, very closely. You know, we all look at five-year plans. And I always personally like to have three sets of numbers. The first one is the business plan. The second one is a conservative approach that's more conservative, and the third one is a little more aggressive. And, you know, if there's some benchmarks you can support that with, that's even better. But the financials are important. And one of the things that, you know, when you talk about elevator pitches and presentations, you know, people invest for one reason. There's a second one, but the main one reason, it's to make money. And so the financials are not just important to see if they're realistic, but if you're saying your company is going to be valued after 5 years at $20 million and people are, you're now raising money and valuing it at $10 million, then you're telling people in 5 years they'll double their money. Venture capitalists traditionally are looking for 10 or 20 times return. So if they put $1 million up, they want 10 million or 20 million back. That used to be more doable. It's gotten more difficult. And they were looking to get that return in, you know, 4 or 5 years. And that's stretched out because of the economy and all. That's stretched out to, you know, 8 to 10 years today for both IPOs and M&As. But again, the key on financials outside of are they reasonable? Do they make sense? Are they doable? Is what kind of, how much money am I going to make, get back if I take a risk? And something people don't understand, but, you know, you mentioned, we mentioned mentors before and advisors, but I would guess that 80 or 90% of early stage, you know, innovative, disruptive companies fail. And even companies backed by venture capitalists, where they have their money and their support that brings, probably 50% fail. You go, are you serious? 50%? So the financials are important, and but the other points are too. And then the last point I look at.
Can I just interrupt you a second? You mentioned you look at the assumptions. Because I realize, yeah, the assumptions are, and the rest is arithmetic. I mean, really, it's just, you know,
right.
Like I was saying earlier, how much does it cost to make the product? What's the cost to market it? What's left? You know, all that kind of stuff. But what are the key assumptions you look at? Which ones are you perhaps most skeptical of? You know, as I tell our customers, don't work the assumptions to make the business work. Because if you put the assumptions that are reasonable and you do the arithmetic and this thing doesn't make any money, you might be better off not doing this business. And I've had customers call and write and say, you know, we spent $100 on your software and found out this business wasn't going to make any money. And we realized that's actually a win. Thank you. You know, we didn't waste our retirement. But when you're looking at this from an investor, what assumptions do you look at that, you know,
I look at them all, but the two big ones, and they basically are the two big ones, are sales or revenue, since they tend to be the same. You know, what's the revenue growth and how are you getting there? And so, you know, if you're going to open 20 branches or carry your line in, you know, 50 stores or sell it on the you know, the internet, those types of things, you know, how are you going to grow the revenues? How realistic is it? And that you usually have to talk after you look at the numbers. You have to challenge and question and dig with the founders to understand a little better whether those are reasonable or not. And the other one on the numbers is the expenses. And, of course, that covers everything. But, I look real, real closely at expenses because ultimately what I'm looking at is both the revenue growth, but more important is the profit growth. And I gave a talk at Dominican University to a Green MBA class. And at the end, I said, I really love green and sustainable. And they all started purring. And I said, green meaning it's profitable, and sustainable meaning I'll be in business not only in 6 weeks, but 6 years. And yeah, so, and by the way, with the green types of businesses, many of which are good, if they're profit driven, they're much more likely to be sustainable and grow than if they're dependent on charity or, you know, some other factor. So the assumptions, you know, is whatever goes into the revenue number, you really have to dig into, and then you really have to look at the expenses. If you're using a direct sales force, as we did at a lot of my companies, that's expensive. And so you have to look at the sales per salesperson and, you know, is it realistic and what is it based on and things like that.
And then if you're putting in a commission for the salesperson, is a real salesperson who would be good, would they be motivated by that commission, or is that commission half what they need to be motivated by? And if you double the commissions, suddenly your profits tank and all that kind of stuff needs to add up.
Yeah. I wrote one of my newsletters on building a sales team and all, And sales incentives are very important. Salespeople tend to be short-term oriented, you know, results-oriented, because that's how they get measured. And the sales, I got enthused and started to lose my thought here. It's sales incentives. Early in the history of a company, and these are just general statements, each case differs perhaps, but I want to pay the salespeople when they bring the order in the door. I want to start putting money in their pocket right away, and because I want them highly motivated. And when we set quotas, so they make, you know, $80,000 if they sell 100% of quota. If they beat their quota, I want to double their incentive for all the dollars they bring me above the quota. And so
instead of capping their commissions, like you can only make so much money, regardless of what I've seen companies do in the past, and I've worked for those, you're saying you're actually accelerating the commission. You reach your quota, and now your commission increases, so it accelerates even more to go further. Is that what I'm hearing?
Absolutely. And the cap and incentive is insane. You want them, in effect, what you're doing is you're sharing the revenue on a larger degree. And I'm very aggressive at that, because if you really build a great sales force, as we did at Centex Telemanagement, you may get 20% or 25% of your sales force beating the quota, maybe a little bit more. And some of them will be substantially beating it. My head of sales made more money than me as CEO 2 or 3 years in a row. I was the happiest duck in the pond because, you know, who benefits? You know, I'm a stockholder, and ultimately I want to be measured on the success of the company. You know, the incentives are very, very important, and longer-term incentives are too, and we talk about that a little bit later perhaps. But so I like everybody to have stock with vesting and things of that sort, stock options. But motivating the sales force is absolutely critical. Having the right management is. And let me touch on that, the last of my 5 points. You know, does the business make sense from the customer's viewpoint? Is the sales channel reasonable and will it work? Is there a real competitive advantage if you do get to that point? And do the numbers make sense? Is the management team? And Bill Draper, Tim Draper is a very famous VC. His dad, Bill Draper, is also famous and is somewhat, well, he's not retired, but he's an older fellow. And he wrote a book called The Startup Game. The first thing he looks is at the management team. But, of course, if you have a very successful reputation as a venture capitalist, you have the luxury of only really spending time with teams that have already been successful. Most of the companies I work with and see are doing it for the first time. It's great when you get one that's done it once or twice before. And on the management team, the question is, it's almost in every case that the management team at some point will have to be expanded. And at some point, you may even have to replace the CEO, or he or she may have to replace himself or herself. So with the management, you want to see, are they working closely together? Do they have the right blend of skills today for what has to be done now? And, you know, are they open to being, do they understand where their weaknesses are so that you might be helpful as a board member or as an advisor in them complementing and building the management team as they, you know, start down the road a bit? So the management team is important. But when I first came out here, one of the VCs that brought me out here, who's been a phenomenal mentor to me and a phenomenal, I've just learned so much from this fellow. But he told me that, and remember, I'm paranoid when I'm running a business. He told me, he said, you know, Pete, with our companies, we have to replace the CEO every year. Holy mackerel, it was that motivation. And I'm not even sure if that's exactly what he said, but that's what I heard. And that's, you know, you don't want to have to do that, but the management team can make a big difference, particularly if they are listening, learning, they are open to advisors of one sort or another. So those are my 5 points. And one of the things that goes with that, if I can jump a little further, Burke, is I had a board when I came out here in 1985. I was brought out by a very young venture capitalist who was 26 years old doing his first deal. And the so I had to make some decisions, and he had, you know, he basically was living in with the company, and I had to make some decisions about, you know, do I throw him out because I don't want conflict as to who's running the company and things like that. And I realized his goal with his first deal was the same as my goal, which was to make this thing successful. And so I quickly outlined some guidelines, which he accepted, that he could talk to anybody, anywhere, anytime. But please don't criticize management. Come and tell me. Don't tell people what to do. Come and tell me. And let's have dinner. I think it was his suggestion, but let's have dinner every week. And we had dinner, and he'd have 8 or 10 items. So this young venture capitalist, he came out of AT&T, so, and he was working on his MBA still. I already had one, but he's very brilliant. But he was helping me 2 or 3 days a week, running around talking to people and looking in and finding things that might need fixing or that needed fixing. That was, and that, why should I not accept that? And so a good board, and he was on our board, isn't your friends and family. They may be if they're investors, but you want tough, smart people that are brutally honest with you. You want them to be supportive, but you don't want them to be yes, sir, yes, sir, yes, ma'am, yes, ma'am. You want them to really help you build a company and be successful. And a good board can do that. I've been on many boards of advisors, and all they want is a name to help raise money. And that doesn't help them. If you have a board member and if you have a weakness in the company, we brought a board member on at Centex who had huge lobbying experience in Washington, D.C., and we thought we might have to do some of that with the FCC. I brought him on the board. Michael Dowling was his name, and he was excellent. But we never needed him, but he was there as a backup. And he was a good board member, but he was there because if I really got into a battle. So the board can be invaluable, and in some ways, it's not the beginning of a company, but in some ways, that's part of the, quote, management team that it can make a huge difference as you're building a company.
You know, the question I want to get to, the things on my mind is the part about being replaced as a CEO, that to me, like as a CEO, it's scary. You're like, ooh, that sucks. You know, and you see these magazine articles, it's almost like the, you know, in the news, they want to report, oh, so-and-so got ousted as CEO, and everybody's, ooh, you know, it's one of those things. But it also goes in with the question of, we talked a little bit earlier about, what do you look for in an entrepreneur to invest in the first place? It seems to me, you know, there's a correlation there between, you know, the person you're going to invest in, you're investing in the person, you know, it's the team who's actually going to spend the money. It's not like here's this company, here's a plan. I'm writing a check to the company. No, I'm writing a check to a person. And at the same time, a year later, or 10 years later, or 5 years later, is that person still the CEO? And it seems like, you know, Steve Jobs, Bill Gates, and a lot of these guys are still CEOs of their companies after over time. What is it that enables them, well, first makes them attractive as a person to invest with in the first place? And then how does one stay CEO without getting kicked out?
Yeah, I'm not sure on the second question that you can stay CEO. You know, the answer, the cliche answer would be you continue to be critical and you're growing as much as the company is growing and you're expanding your skills and you're bringing in management teams that fill it out and help you as much as possible. But when I was running Centex Telemanagement, I understood all the details of the business. I did micromanage, but I did dig into things very deeply at times so I would understand them. And the problem was that, in fact, believe it or not, that if an invoice was over something like $25 or $50, all those checks and invoices had to come through my desk. And obviously, I didn't have time to look at them. The pile was 1 or 2 inches thick every day. So I'd look, they'd come in on Monday morning and Monday night. I'd put them in my out basket. Occasionally, I'd reach in and pull one out and call Fred up or Mary up and say, hey, what's this all about? So people knew I was looking at it. I wanted cost consciousness. But
yeah,
the problem with that approach, as we got, we were doing our final year close to $200 million of business. And we had 12,000 small business customers spread around 22 branches, and I think we were in 12 states. The problem with that is that the last 2 years, I should have brought in a COO And ultimately, and I started to do that just before we got acquired, but I should have done it 2 years before, because strategically, the market, particularly for long distance, which was part of where we made, most of our money, was dropping. The cost percent per call was dropping tremendously. We needed to look at, you know, much more aggressive selling of value-added services and things like that, and we were doing some of it, but I was too focused on the details. And we got saved because we were acquired for a very nice price, but we would have been in trouble otherwise. So I don't know, I ran the company for 9 years. That's a long time. I think the biggest thing would be, if you're a CEO and you have maybe not a lot of experience, is to have good advisors, whether they're on your board or just, you know, mentors or advisors, that you know, there's somebody you can talk to differently than talking to the associates in your company. But that's, it's a tough one. And I think your first question, Burke, was what do I look for in the CEO?
Well, in the entrepreneur in the first place, it's kind of like what you're talking about with the angel at lunch. You know, he didn't like the guy. So the guy had a great business, but he apparently wasn't likable, or wasn't liked by the angel anyway. And I wonder, how can an entrepreneur make sure they're likable to an investor?
I have an engineering undergraduate degree, and so for the first 20 years of my business, I always thought, you know, it's pure facts that win the battle, and do a good job, and the world will recognize it. And if you're selling something, do it. And it wasn't until I really started to hang out with the salespeople, and I did some myself, that I realized that one of the most important ingredients of a good salesperson was that they're likable across the table when they're pitching. And so that's you know, clearly a piece of it. I'm sorry, I'm missing part of the question you asked there, Burke.
Well, I just wonder what in your, you know, from your perspective, you know, as an investor and advisor, and especially just with entrepreneurs, what makes an entrepreneur more likable than say another one? You've worked with ones that weren't likable and ones that are. Yeah, what would you like? If you could pick three things that people would listen here and think, "Ooh, I need to be maybe less numbers oriented and be more social or more what?" I mean, more.
Yeah, I think enthusiasm is very important, but the first one is not to be pugnacious, not to be arrogant, not to take questions as challenges. You know, the things we talked about before. You have to, you know, but it's equally important, if not more so, that you're really passionate, and it comes across the table that you're really passionate and you're a deep believer in what you're doing. Obviously, a great example of that was Chandra Shekhar, who's the founder of Exodus Communications, and he led it for their first absolutely unbelievable 3 or 4 years. And it was the fastest growing earnings, I think, in NASDAQ history, but it was up in that range. And Chandra had an accent. He came here from India with, $500 in his pocket. And he got very excited when he was talking about things. And I thought when they were going public, I thought, boy, these financial analysts are not going to react properly to that. They loved him. And I went, and again, I'm always learning. I went, huh? And they loved him because he not only had passion and enthusiasm, but he knew the facts about the whole industry. He knew all the competitors. He knew what his advantages were, how he was going to get there, how he got where he was, all of those points like that. So the enthusiasm is important, but equally important is that they really understand what they're talking about, not just, you know, not just their own business, but even there I run into a lot who don't fully understand their own business, but more importantly, the whole industry. So passion, definitely. Passion, facts, you know, enthusiasm based on facts, and being likable. And, you know, the first impression you make, in one of the books I wrote that I co-authored, I just wrote a chapter in it, on the world's leading experts tell you how to improve your health, wealth, and success, called Trendsetters. One of the authors of the chapter is a hairdresser. I thought, what the heck does the hairdresser have to do with the Pete Howleys in life? You know, we're the superstars. But she had very good advice about relating to her customers and how she talked, what she talked about, how she dressed, and things like that. And that's absolutely true for salespeople, whatever level they are. And I think everybody saw Zuckerman's reaction at Facebook when he showed up with a hood. And, you know, basically it was seen as disrespect to these, you know, ego-driven analysts in Wall Street. That wasn't smart. And it may have been part of the culture back at headquarters, but he didn't understand. He didn't fit in. So understanding who you're talking to, and, you know, you don't have to copy them, but you have to understand what the impact of your dress and appearance and all. And the biggest thing I've had to learn, I go into meetings and I'm very serious, and particularly if I'm selling something, I've got to learn to relax, at least appear relaxed, smile, and give them a big handshake and a big smile. Hey, really nice meeting you. I appreciate the time you've given me. People warm up, and I suppose it's when we lived in caves. It's a sign that you're not a risk or danger when you smile.
Interesting. Yeah, I think that it goes much further than perhaps we think. If we're not conscious of our own appearance and how we come across energetically, I mean, energetically, I mean, just like being happy and enthusiastic, and not just enthusiastic for its own sake, but really, like you say, passion and have a just get the business and why are you here? And I read something recently where they talk about in marketing why people buy from you is not because so much of what it is you sell, but why you sell it. And so talking about, you know, like, why are you into this, you know, and it's interesting to get some of the background. Like, I used to read Popular Science and Popular Mechanics and think, you know, all these things are great, you know, and I worked for companies that had some really great stuff, but then they did something stupid and the company went out of business. I'm like, you know, how can we help these businesses keep the good stuff out there, you know? Or you go to a restaurant that you really, really liked, and the restaurant is closed. You're like, no, you know. And so how can you keep these people in business, you know, so you can enjoy their product or service is what gets me going. But anyway.
Yeah.
So,
you know, there's – I'm sorry. Go ahead, Burke.
Well, I was just going to move on to a part about – and this could tie into some of the challenges for raising money, just, you know, what does an entrepreneur need to think about? What other ideas entrepreneurs need to have? And they're going to be likable for all those reasons. They've got a plan with the numbers and your 5 points. And what else would they need to really focus on?
Let me back up. That ties into what we were talking about just before. A question that I'm writing a newsletter on ethics. And, you know, are ethics important? We're talking about management and what qualities do you look for in a CEO. And one of the companies I was involved with, I subsequently decided that the founder was a sociopath. And I don't even know what that is, but apparently that's a person who will say whatever it takes. And they're very good. They can be very good salespeople, but they'll say or promise or explain whatever it takes. And when I was running a public company, I had a quote that everybody in the company knew, which was, if I can't explain it comfortably on the front page of the Wall Street Journal, whether I get there or not, but if I can't explain it comfortably on the front page of the Wall Street Journal, don't do it. And they'd say, what do you mean by that? Well, you can frequently, if not always, get an accounting opinion or a legal opinion that says it's legal or it's accounting. But how many of us are happy about the head of one of the big investment banks in Wall Street taking billion-dollar bailouts from your tax money and paying himself $110 million for that year? Is it legal? Yes. Is it fit the accounting rules? Yes. Is it ethical? Not in my view. It smells. And so I think when you're dealing with an entrepreneur or a CEO, when you're looking at a company, and it's a mistake I've made in the past once or twice, is I didn't look close enough or far enough. Sometimes that's involved doing reference checks or something. But they basically were, you know, just had a glib answer, and that's where you do want to do your homework, but they had a glib answer and a good answer for everything, and it turned out that, you know, part of it wasn't true. So I think, and today in the world, you know, of instant communications, there are no secrets. And, you know, so whether you believe in it from a moral viewpoint, which I think is important to our society, but or not, and, you know, I always felt the reason I was, you know, scrupulously a Boy Scout when I was involved in business wasn't that I was always perfect. It was that I didn't want to jeopardize anything in my career to some stupid move that came to light later or at the time. And so I think ethics is still very, like very important.
It stays with you forever, for your whole life. Like if you did something like something really illegal or just unethical or just crooked or whatever at any point, you back 10 years ago, 20 years ago, it's not, maybe it doesn't go in your credit report like a bankruptcy might. I mean, a bankruptcy is one of those things, but, you know, a real dishonest act, I think, would stick with you forever. Anybody who knew you and you knew you did a dishonest thing, you know, years down the road, you never know when they're going to cross paths with them again. They're going to say, you know what, this guy was a crook way back when. And it seems like that's something you never, ever, ever live down. So I think the Boy Scout thing is well worth maintaining.
Yeah. And one of the sayings that I picked up in college from one of my good friends was make your enemies by choice, not by chance. And the other side of that, when we were going public with Centex Telemanagement, I said we were, I think I used the word innovative. And we got challenged when we filed the IPO filing, and I had kept in contact once or twice a year with Dixon Dahl, who's now a very, very successful VC out here with DCM, but at the time he was a consultant in Ann Arbor, but he'd written a book on data communications and things, and so I just contacted him and he wrote up, he said, no, because he knew the industry. He said, no, you're an innovator. Nobody else is doing this. And he gave me a strong letter that supported it, and we got to use that word. So doing good also can have, you know, a lot of times the benefit you never, you know, it's like running into somebody at the train station. What are you doing here? I thought you lived in Singapore. So being an ethical, honest business person and person and not doing stupid things, and none of us are perfect, in this world makes even greater sense than it did, you know, perhaps before we had instant communications.
Yeah, that's for sure. So what else would be useful for entrepreneurs to know about raising capital? I mean, it occurs to me that bootstrapping is something one should do as long as possible, or just, you know, to get as many things in place before they need money. I go to these conferences and you ask people what they need next, and they go, oh, I need capital. And I ask them, do you have a business plan together? Do you have a board of advisors together? Do you have any potential customers lined up? No, I don't have anything. I need capital. And I think, well, you know, what else can somebody do before they raise the money? Or what else can they do to be attractive to money? What would you say about that?
Some of what we've talked about, of course, is very important. The business plan itself is very important. Having the elevator pitch where in 2 minutes or 5 or 10, depending on the time frame, but let's take 2 minutes, you can say enough to catch somebody, you know, the hook. You can excite them about the potential, you know. We have some IP that allows us to do this. And, you know, and we it looks like we can build a $100 million business in 3 years. You know, you need to be able to catch them. So remembering why people invest, it's to make money, is always important versus selling how clever the idea is. You need to understand that. One of the things that's most important when I was, again, raising money for Centex, one of the ultimate investors, we had a lot of technology working in our favor, and no, this was for IP Wireless, a later company, and it was a broadband mobile platform that was way, 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 it was 4G, way ahead of its time, and so I was explaining how it worked and where the competition was, and he said, you've got to give an example up front of what is the advantage of this business, and the answer in my case there was, you walk into a store, you buy a computer, you go home, you plug it in, or you go to the office, you plug it in, or you turn it on if it's mobile, and you want to click on an icon, put in a little information, and have broadband mobile connection that's powerful. That's what our service is, and nobody else does it today. So giving an example up front, a real example, can be very helpful. You know, contacts, one of the companies I worked with 10 or 12 years ago, a very interesting guy, he had no hesitation, politely, but he would call, you know, people like Andy Grove, and you can get contact information today on anybody. And it always surprised me how frequently he would get them, and in some cases they would invest. So, but the more you can develop contacts that can open doors for you or add credibility to what you're doing, you know, absolutely important. And one last thing, a point I've made many times, I have a live example, but I don't want to eat up too much time on it. It's much better to own 10% of a huge success than 90% of a failure. So,
right.
You know, particularly if it's your first deal, you want to bring smart people on board. You want to raise smart money if you can, and you want it to be successful, and you'll make some money out of it. But if you're purely focused on your ownership piece, and you don't want to ignore it, but if you're purely focused on your ownership piece, you're going to miss some of those people that would be real helpful. Because if you did it once and you succeed, you'll probably do it a second or third time.
So how much stock do you give your people in this? I am curious about that. You know, how you, like the CTO. I guess it depends. I guess if I come in with a team and I have my five people, we're all together, we want to do this thing together. Do we all get, you know, like 5% of the stock, or how do you figure that? Can you answer that in a couple of minutes or less?
No, I'm out of date on the stock distribution. There are regular numbers, and I just haven't looked at that lately. Usually, if there's three founders, you know, who start something, they equally split that at that point. But if there's one person, and frequently one person has, like Steve Jobs, has a real strong partner in the early days, or Bill Gates, or you know, they all had a strong partner that complemented what they were doing. So they probably at that point, you know, are splitting it evenly. But once you start hiring people outside or bringing them on, I don't have a current number for that. They're published, and when I need them, I look them up.
Yeah, okay. That's easy enough. Well, we've got a couple minutes left here. Is there, what else would you like to say about this? I like what you said about the elevator pitch. You've got to lead. You're in the elevator. How many floors do you give them? I heard somebody talk one time. They said, the elevator pitch, imagine you're going 26 floors. I'm thinking, not in this town, you're not, you know. You're 26 floors. Are you kidding me? You're lucky if you get three, you know. But I wonder, you know, so in the elevator pitch, I'm in the elevator with you. You go, hey, Peter, you know, I got this new intellectual property that helps me connect the computer and up with a push of a button, and I think I can turn this business into $100 million in 3 years. Could I come talk to you? How's that for an elevator pitch?
Yeah, I would like it. Usually you have to have a couple words about the business itself without trying to get into a lot of detail. And you need to be extremely aware of what they will hear. Because if you say, I've got this platform that is absolutely perfect for Salesforce and for salespeople, and it'll help them increase sales and manage it way better, and I only need to raise $1 million and it will be worth $50 million in 3 years, people right away go think, what do you have in sales that Salesforce doesn't have already in their way down there? You know, that. So it's not just to have a good, very brief explanation that's exciting about the company, but to understand how they'll hear it. And, you know, because it's hard to find – everybody's doing whatever you're doing frequently. And
yeah,
the real question is, how are you different, or how are you going to be the fastest out the gate so that you'll have the first mover advantage? And that's what you've got to get across. If you have a real strong player involved, it doesn't hurt to mention that. But, yeah, elevator pitches are tough. I gave one for one of my clients in Vancouver who couldn't make it down here, and I had 2 minutes, and I got eaten alive. Because it was a complicated, business, and it was very hard to get, you know, to put it into concise terms, and not have it sound like ITZY and a whole bunch of other companies that were in the general space.
It's got to be 30 seconds to 2 minutes. Give an example, something about how much money you need, any profound players on the table with you, and it can't be like something that's already existing.
Yeah, or make sure it's clear how it differs or is better. But exactly, that's a great summary.
Okay, Peter, thank you so much. We are out of time. I wish I could go on all the rest of the afternoon and talk to them. People really like to hear what you've got to say because you've been there, done that, and you know, put money in and got taken money out and run companies. So anyway, Peter Howley, the Howley Management Group. It's Howley Management.com. So www.HowleyManagement.com is where to find you. And thank you so much for being on Business Black Belt Radio with me, Peter.
My pleasure, and everybody have a great day, and hopefully you've gotten something that's helpful to you.
I think so. Thanks a lot. I'll talk to you later. Thank you.